Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 322 for March 4th, 2016. The bar that created the car. Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to AutoLine After Hours. We have a rather special show today. As you'll notice, I'm here, John's not. But we have some very smart guys here in the studio with us, as well as one who will be joining us by phone. So first of all, I want to welcome A.J. Baim, who is an author of a fabulous book, which I'd highly recommend, The Arsenal of Democracy. And I think we're going to get into some of that because we're going to be talking about history of the auto industry. We have Matt Anderson from the Transportation Department of the Henry Ford Museum. He's a curator there.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And by phone, we have Dan Austin, who is a historian. He is the founder of historicdetroit.org. That's all one word, historicdetroit.org. And he is the author of a couple books, Forgotten Landmarks of Detroit and Lost Detroit.
Great to be here, Paul.
Great, thank you. Dan.
In absentia, anyway.
And so one of the subjects we want to talk about is the famous Pontchartrain Hotel in Detroit. Now, as I told you guys earlier, that when I heard about this subject, I was thinking about the Pontchartrain that exists across the street from Cobo Center, and I'm completely wrong, right?
Yeah, totally different building, right? That's a new building that's an homage to the old original Pontchartrain Hotel.
And so where was the original Pontchartrain Hotel?
It was at Campus Marsis, just a little south of the square there, but on the east side of Woodward Avenue. It's a very prominent location where the First National Building is today.
And so that was created when?
It was the Pontchartrain Hotel opened actually in October of 1907, and it was only up until 1920, so about 13 years. Not a very long run, but managed to make quite a bit of history in that brief window.
So Dan, you've written about this. Why is this building important?
Well, they call it the Mother of Motors. It was basically the nursery for the auto industry as we know it today. This is at a time when Detroit was, this was a pre-motor city. Detroit was just kind of coming into its own, going from a dusty, you know, it had more than kind of the Wild West than it did the Midwest. So the Horace and John Dodges of the world, the William Durants, the Henry Fords, the Lelands, the Chevrolets, they all needed a place to kind of congregate and exchange ideas, brainstorm, forge partnerships, things like that, and they all congregated at the Ponch and the bar there. It was right across from Old City Hall, so already was kind of known as the place where the power brokers went to meet. And so the auto industry has kind of followed suit. You know, it was the place to go at the time.
So was there any option? I mean, was there, or was that it?
In 1907, I mean, that was kind of it. I mean, you have to keep in mind that Detroit's population grew exponentially very quickly, and that was due in large part to the auto industry. So the Ponch, when it opened in 1907, was kind of a game changer because we had mostly the kind of dingy, dank, you know, danky kind of saloon type of places around town. When the Ponch opened, I mean, this place changed the game, right? I mean, Tiffany Studios dressed it to the nines. I mean, the ice scoops, for crying out loud, were made of silver. I mean, there was no place like it in Detroit. And if you are trying to impress people and really get your business going, I mean, why would you go anywhere else other than the Ponch?
I think viewers should try to. The great thing about the Ponch to me is that you could try to imagine yourself walking into this place in 1908, 1909. Here was a place they called the Mother of Motors. This is where all, you know, right at the dawn of the automobile industry, and it was all happening here in Detroit. And this is where people came. They would literally bring pieces of machinery in, set it at the bar, and set it in motion. And if you came in here to buy, Dan, it was a 10-cent glass of beer or 15-cent glass of beer?
Yeah, beer for a dime, 15 cents for a whiskey.
32-foot mahogany bar, and you could sit down next to Henry Ford, who was a teetotaler, but the Dodge brothers certainly won. So you'd have Henry Ford here, and you'd have the Dodge brothers here, and William Durant, Lewis Chevrolet. you know, all sitting there talking about this, you know, and one of the fascinating things, it wasn't just all these amazingly famous people we think about today. It was a tremendous number of men with big dreams who created things that never went anywhere that we don't know of today.
I mean, I guess you could kind of think of it as some of those reality shows or whatever, like Shark Tank or whatever, where people would roll in their devices or their inventions. You know, maybe I had a great new idea for a crankshaft. Or Albert Champion brought in his porcelain spark plugs into the Punch to pitch to these auto barons. You know, they pitched their ideas. And fortunes were made, or, you know, not, just in these sessions at the Punch. So it really is a fascinating thing to try to envision. I mean, all of these people who are legends, you know, the Durants and the Dodges and all these folks, just sitting at the bar, you know, having a couple rounds, and you come in like, hey, you know, Horace, I got this great idea for a new way to make a chassis. I mean, it's just a fascinating thing to think about, that is how the auto industry kind of was born, and that's why the Punch was called the mother of motors.
I thought it was interesting in the piece you wrote about the Pontchartrain, Dan, you quote Alfred P. Sloan saying, the Pontchartrain was where motor car gossip was heard first. I thought that was sort of interesting. The gossip was heard first. And I just wonder, is it your sense that when the industry was starting, there was a whole lot of gossip, or was this basically just a lot of competition going on?
I think there was quite a bit of gossip, and everybody wanted to know what the next business's plans were so they could stay ahead of the competition. And there's a great story with Henry Ford. He got interested in cycle cars in the early teens. These were the cheaply made cars, frankly, with motorcycle engines and components, little two-seaters. So they were a direct threat to the Model T. And Ford wasn't too happy about this, so he built, in what was really just a great bluff at the end of the day, a prototype cycle car that was basically a three-quarter scale version of a Model T. And then his son Edsel takes a look at this thing and said, what are we going to do with this? And Henry tells him, go drive it where everybody will see it. Park in front of the Pontchartrain Hotel. Yeah. So that's what Edsel does. Everybody sees that little vehicle there with the Ford on it, and they kind of freak out, thinking Henry's going to get into cycle cars, and he helps to ensconce some of the competition that way.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. And you've done extensive work on Edsel Ford. Were you aware of that story?
Here's a fascinating story about Edsel that I love. Edsel and Henry were very, very different people, and Henry was this sober, you know, workaholic, and he would go in there and talk about cars. But Edsel, it was rumored that Edsel taught Detroit how to do the rumba at the Punch.
At the Punch.
At the Punch.
So presumably there was a bar and then a dance hall next to it?
Well, I think there was a bar, and then there would have been a dance hall, and there was a restaurant where the onion soup was quite famous. Yes, the rumba. You can picture it. You can hear it in your head right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't just motor cars that were famous at the Punch. It was the place to go in Detroit. So when presidents came in from out of town, they stayed at the Punch. There were famous murders there. There were, you know, celebrities and vaudeville players, and a lot happened there.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the interesting thing to me is that, you know, we talk about many of these famous people. I mean, so now Dodge is running commercials with the Dodge brothers and showing that they were, you know, of the time, and they were, is that true? I mean, were the brothers really as footloose and fancy free as they seem to be portrayed?
I think there is a kernel of truth in those
really?
Ads. I'm not sure they were ever quite swinging from chandeliers like that, but there are stories of them throwing furniture, getting a little too inebriated, and you know, Horace does die, you know, from pneumonia, but also from cirrhosis of the liver. So I
really?
Think they really were alcoholics.
They were famous drinkers, and I think they could be people who were very difficult to do business with. You wanted to be aligned with them and not against them if you could.
So basically, these guys were sort of like the who in a hotel room, just trashing the place. I mean, is that what we have going on here?
I think so. I don't know. It's hard to say. But there was one famous story of Ty Cobb, the famous baseball player, in 1919, and he gets in trouble at the Pontchartrain for beating up a chambermaid and throwing her down a flight of stairs. And that made national news. That was in the New York Times.
So Dan, what other stories have you uncovered about the Pontchartrain bar?
Well, man, the parties were pretty notorious. And they would not name Horace and John Dodge as being the big partiers, but I could tell you that when the place closed, for example, They had a giant going away party where they basically smashed all the furniture, lit it on fire. People were, you know, carrying silver out left and right. I think that there was certainly, despite being high class, there was certainly a raucous kind of legacy that the Ponch had. It was where the rich and famous went to party. But yeah, as far as other stories, I mean, there are countless ones. I mean, you mentioned the vaudeville stars. I mean, Detroit's entertainment district was on Monroe. Right now, the National Theater on Monroe near Randolph and Farmer is the only survivor of that. But that was kitty corner, basically, from the Ponch. So that's where all the vaudeville stars went. You know, the other thing that is worth mentioning is that this hotel replaced the other prominent hotel, top hotel in Detroit before that, which was a Russell House. And that was also a place known for some debauchery. So maybe there's just some bad juju about the site. I don't know. Something about the southeast corner of Cadillac and Woodward that makes people want to drink. I don't know. The First National that's there today seems like kind of a quiet place. I'm actually looking out the window at it right now from Coleman A. Young Municipal Center.
Is the Pontchartrain more important to its contribution to the nascent auto industry, or is it more important because it was the place that sort of put Detroit on the map in terms of movers and shakers and entertainers and politicians?
To me, it's the mother of motors. I mean, it has this great place in the history of automobiles. I mean, at the time, Detroit was basically what you think of Silicon Valley today. There was a new industry that was changing, revolutionizing human life in so many different ways, and it was all happening here, and all these new inventions were all people were bringing them to that bar to discuss them. Mm-hmm. It would be like, you know, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and all of these guys sitting at the same bar talking about, you know, is this Facebook thing going to work? I don't know. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's the mother of motors. There's nothing like it else anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's a great site of a big meeting that resulted in a business merger that didn't happen, actually, too. In 1908, the Morgan banking interests had gotten together with Billy Durant with this idea of consolidating the four largest automakers at that time, which would have been Durant's own Buick, it would have been Ransom Olds' Rio, it would have been Maxwell, and would have been Ford. And they met at the Pontchartrain, not in the bar, precisely because it was so frequented by other auto industry types. They didn't want to be seen. They were having these kind of quiet discussions. So they met up in Billy Durant's suite. And in the end, you know, Ford didn't want any part of it. There are a few things he hated as much as financiers and money men. So he backed out of the deal. It collapsed. But it's interesting to think what might have happened. I mean, there could have been no Model T, could have been no General Motors, no auto industry as we know it. It would have been a very different thing had that deal gone through.
So wouldn't it sort of been General Motors, but different? I mean,
the same idea, yes, just under a different name. But, you know, a lot of those manufacturers were building sort of solid middle-priced cars, too. So they would have essentially been building the same thing instead of that integrated product line we associate with GM. So mm-hmm. Surely they would have changed a little. But, you know, it's one of those what-ifs we could wonder about forever.
And this was Morgan as in J.P. Morgan?
Correct, yes.
So the guy from New York comes to town and meets with these guys from Detroit and says, I want to put this conglomerate together.
Exactly. Well, you know, it was the glamorous new industry at the time, the automobile uh-huh. industry, so everybody wanted to.
Which sort of goes to what you're saying, AJ, about it being the Silicon Valley of the time.
Indeed. Dan, you found something in your research that I just want to point out. You touched on something. When the Ponch closed, it was really the end of the era. And I want, like, if you can picture in your mind what it was like when they take all the furniture and light a bonfire in this cordoned-off hotel, which was, you know, massive. It started out as 10 stories. They added five. It was a skyscraper mm-hmm. at the time. So they have this bonfire going on in the inside. And this is what someone said. In the dying embers of that farewell blaze, there passed away old Detroit. So by the time in 1920, the Detroit that, you know, was completely different city and the automobile was a different industry, the industry was different. And America was a completely different place because of the inventions in that, you know, that were shown in that bar. So mm-hmm. maybe that answers your question.
So Matt, give us a sense of what was the auto industry in 1920.
Well, by 1920, it's fairly mature. You have your big winners at that point. Other companies are starting to go out of business. In fact, in 1920 or shortly after, there's a big crash because now we have a lot of used cars on the market. So all of a sudden, you know, a lot of these folks getting in to the new car market, they have other options rather than buying a new vehicle. So things slow down. But prior to that, it really was, I think, as Dan had mentioned, kind of the Wild West in the auto industry as well. Everybody was trying to get in. You didn't need much more than just a crazy idea to get somebody to invest and you know, push your company along. And you could fail multiple times. Henry Ford fails twice before he succeeds in Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. So I think some of that is reflected in the Hotel Pontchartrain, too, that realizing that the industry is growing, the hotel grows up alongside it. But then the hotel kind of fades away for the auto industry because it reaches a certain degree of maturity. It's Henry Joy, the president of the Packard Company, that decides, you know, maybe we're a little above meeting in bars on Woodward Avenue. Maybe we need a better, more dignified space. So that sort of encourages Joy to lead the effort to build the new Detroit Athletic Club, which opens in 1915, and that becomes the new center of auto industry activity.
Mm-hmm. Which is sort of curious to me when I read that, and I was thinking, well, okay, so fundamentally, what's the difference between a bar in an athletic club and a bar in a hotel? I mean, especially since the athletic club has rooms that people can stay in.
Well, for starters, you're heading into prohibition, right? So, I mean, liquor itself is a major social issue. Pro, against, you know, that was one of the issues. Another issue that added to the closing of the Ponch was a new hotel called the Statler. And the Statler was one of the first chains of hotels, which I think is really interesting. They had this primitive air conditioned system. And anybody who lives around Detroit or anywhere in the country where it gets warm, imagine, you know, a world with no air conditioning. So here is this new hotel where they piped ice water through the walls to try to keep the place cool.
And they also boasted that every room had its own bathroom.
Every room had its own bathroom. So it started in Buffalo and Cleveland, and then we had one in Detroit, I think, in 1917. And then they built Statler built a famous hotel in St. Louis where Harry Truman had some famous meetings in his early Senate campaigns.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, did the Statler catch on at all with the auto people, or was it not
no.
the same sort of thing?
No. Yeah, the DAC opened in 1915, as did the Statler. So they basically moved from the Ponch to the DAC, and I think all of the points made, I didn't even think about the prohibition thing. That's a great point. But it was, think about it, you're trying to change the world in a hotel bar. Why not go to an exclusive club? And I mean, anyone could walk into the Hotel Ponch bar, mm-hmm. you know, but you had to be a member to get into the DAC. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of, you know, one of the reasons why Henry B. Joy wanted their own place. We were big boys. We had graduated from the little kids' table. Let's have our own place. But the Statler, I mean, it certainly helped put the Ponch out of business. And in fact, the DAC and the Statler really were what delivered the 1-2 death punch, mm-hmm. I think, for the Hotel Pontchartrain. I mean, Detroit had grown up so fast, and technology and the amenities and hotels had changed just in that small 13-year window. I mean, the idea of a hotel room that does not have its own bathroom. I mean, when the Statler showed up in Detroit, it changed the game. Mm-hmm. And so now all of a sudden, it's like, well, why would I stay at the Ponch? It might not be old, but I mean, it doesn't have any of the bells and whistles. The air conditioning, huge. I mean, the Ponch's big claim to fame was that it had a telephone in every hotel room. I mean, you know, so it's just times, tastes. It had changed, and then when the auto industry moved out, I mean, its days were numbered. It was sitting on one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in Detroit at that time, so it's not a huge wonder that it made the way for progress.
Mm-hmm. So basically, the Detroit Athletic Club, if I'm trying to think about where the original Ponch was, I mean, it's essentially within walking distance, isn't it?
Yeah, a couple blocks.
Yeah, but I mean, not a huge distance that, I mean, it was, if you were used to going to the Ponch, getting to the DAC would not be an issue, geographically.
And I'm going to go out on a limb and guess the Outer Barons all had cars anyway. I mean, you know, one of the other quick things that I know I'm a little behind in the conversation, but I think it's easy for those of us who are not huge gearheads to forget how much the auto industry has changed since 1907, 1920, and I don't mean just in terms of the cars themselves, but keep in mind the number of makes that were in Detroit alone at that time. I mean, we've talked about a couple of names, Maxwell, Hupp, Chalmers. I mean, there were so many of these guys, so many companies. I mean, you know, Lincoln was doing its own thing at that time. It wasn't part of the Ford family. I mean, like all of these car makers all over the place coming down to congregate in one location. So, I mean, it's kind of like the UN of the auto industry if you think of it that way. You had big players and small alike, including some small players that nobody's ever heard of, you know, those really small firms. So anyway, it's one of those stories that people in Detroit probably forgotten about, because now we're coming up on almost 100 years since the hotel came down. And when you hear the name Pontchartrain, you think of the wine cellars or the what's now the Crown Plaza over there by Cobo. You know, a lot of people say on my website or in my talks, like, that's not the Hotel Pontchartrain. The Hotel Pontchartrain is all modern looking. This hotel, even though it lasted for only 13 years, left such a legacy on Detroit that, you know, 35, 40 years after it was demolished, when they built Detroit's newest, fanciest hotel, they honored that legacy by naming it after the Ponch.
See, I must admit, when I first heard about we were going to do the show on the Pontchartrain, I thought it was the hotel that we now know as the Crown Plaza. And when John Ricardo died a couple of weeks ago, there was reports about how there had been meetings in the Pontchartrain Hotel to get Lee Iacocca to come over to Chrysler, and I thought, oh, that's the Pontchartrain, not realizing that this was this other building that no longer exists. So I guess it would be sort of, as the title of your book, Lost Detroit. That's a part that is lost to many of us who've lived here all our lives.
Anyway, yeah.
I can pick up, Dan, you made a really fascinating point there. I just want to read one quick quote, because one of the things that fascinates me about the Ponch and the people who were there was the fabulous, fabulous amounts of money that was at stake at that time. So this is from an ancient Detroit history. Detroit in those days was seething with intensity. Millions were tossed into a pot and lost. Pennies were tossed into a different pot and came out millions. Any of the people who invested in the original Ford Motor Company or the third iteration made fabulous, fabulous amounts of money through tiny little investments. At the same time, when you think about some of the people who might have been, you know, stopped in the Ponch for a beer, David Dunbar Buick died a pauper. Louis Chevrolet died a pauper. It's amazing that, you know, how the fortunes shook out. Of course, the Ponch, as we know now, was one of the fortunes that did not shake out in the end.
So why did these guys die as paupers?
Well, part of the reason is they sold their companies to others. Part of the reasons was they had falling outs. So Chevrolet and Durant had quite a falling out. You know, Chevrolet, being a race driver, had this idea that the Chevrolet automobile would be a big high-priced sort of sports car, a speedster. Not the case. Of course, Chevrolet became a low-priced budget car. So, you know, in some respects, it was just being in the wrong place at the wrong time or selling out a little too quickly. And one of the reasons Ford was so successful is that he held on to the control of his company. In fact, he was almost maniacal about it. And the Dodge brothers got wealthy as suppliers for Ford, too. And, you know, it was only later, much later, that they went on to form their own car company.
Mm-hmm. And it was Walter P. Chrysler later than those guys, or was it contemporaneous, or how did that work out?
Chrysler gets in a little later than some of these guys. He's starting in the late 19-teens. He starts with Maxwell, actually, and then moves off to form his own company.
Mm-hmm. So would he have been at the Pontchartrain bar?
He would have been, I think, a little less likely to have seen him at that time than you would some of the others.
But. So he would have been an athletic club guy? Or
right, yeah, second generation.
Uh-huh. It's very interesting that, you know, it's sort of sad now when you drive around Detroit. It's sort of this, archaeological looking at these ruins and that sort of thing of this industry. And, since you don't live here, AJ, you must be more aware of that than perhaps we are, because we see it all the time. How does that strike you?
Well, it all just amazes me. Every time I come here and I come here a bunch and I drive down the road and I see the street signs, and it's just the history is magical. And it's all here. And it just fascinates me. There's no place else in the country where you can drive around and see, just like, have this history right in your face. I mean, the names of the roads and I love coming here for that reason.
Mm-hmm. So while we have you here and we're talking about the history of this industry your book, The Arsenal of Democracy, which I highly recommend that anybody read. At first, I mean, I got it as a Christmas present, and I thought, gee, I'm not all that interested about World War II. And I started reading it and suddenly realized that this is a book about the auto industry more than it's about war. And it's a lot about Edsel Ford and his relationship with his father. So tell us a little bit about that, and I'm sure that you have some insights that you can share on this as well, Matt.
Well, I wrote the book. I had done a lot of research on Edsel Ford while writing another book called Go Like Hell, and a lot of that book takes place mostly in the 1960s. So I had all this material on Edsel Ford, and I was fascinated with Edsel. And I figured out that Edsel's story really hadn't been told in a way that I thought really needed to be told. And I realized that there was a way to tell Edsel's fascinating story in a way that also, at the same time, you could tell this fabulous story about what happened in Detroit in World War II, how the war was fought, how the war was won, and what FDR's strategy was for winning the war. Mm-hmm. You know, he gave the speech on December 29th, 1940, called the Arsenal of Democracy. And the idea was we're going to merge military, free enterprise, and government into this massive arsenal to build these weapons of war. And, of course, the automobile industry was going to play the starring role. And so I tried to tell that story with the focus on Edsel and Henry because their story during the war was so fascinating. I could go on. But.
Well, basically, these guys. I thought for me anyway, part of the big thing was it Henry and Edsel go out to California and see them building airplanes and just throwing up their hands and saying, "This is crazy. We got to build one like cars."
Basically, Edsel goes out to stays at the Coronado Hotel in San Diego to see the Consolidated operation. Consolidated was building this B-24 bomber and. People should understand the bomber was a new thing. I mean, we built, I think the B-17 was prototyped in 1935, and then the 24 came a few years later, and these all of a sudden were the weapons that were going to win the war, FDR thought. So FDR is saying, like, how are we going to get thousands and thousands and thousands of these bombers as quickly as possible? So the Fords go out there, they see the consolidated operation, they understand that this airplane is going to be extremely valuable, but nobody knows how to mass produce it. It had never been done. Fully loaded, this was a 60,000-pound airplane with four massive engines carrying 8,000 pounds of bombs. It had never been mass-produced. The Fords tried to figure a way how to do it, and what they did was build a factory called Willow Run. It was the biggest factory in the world under one roof, and that project really captured the imagination of America.
And so Willow Run is in Ypsilanti, which is west of Detroit. So it basically caused this little town in southeastern Michigan to grow up around this factory.
Well, they brought in so many workers to work in this little factory, they didn't anticipate that people weren't going to be able to use tires because of rationing. They couldn't figure out a way to get workers to the plant, so they had to build something called Bomber City. And it was actually FDR's idea to build this thing he called Bomber City, to build a city next to this giant factory so that people could build these bombers. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everything went drastically wrong in 1942 and 1943. But by 1944, it went very right, and that's why the B-24 is still today the most mass-produced American military aircraft of all time.
Mm-hmm. So Dan or Matt, I mean, do you have any sense of whether, I mean, the creation of Willow Run had a negative effect on the city of Detroit? I mean, as people moved out of the city, as manufacturing moved west out of the city?
You know, I think Willow Run is sort of at the forefront of that movement as plants start to move out further into the suburbs. And, you know, they don't do that so much just to escape Detroit, but because the nature of manufacturing had changed by that point. You couldn't build a big vertical sort of multi-story building to build cars in anymore. You had to have flat space to have a level assembly line. And mm-hmm. It's after the war when that trend really starts to pick up. And, yeah, that does, I think, play a role in mm-hmm. the shift in the economy and the focus here from Detroit to the mm-hmm. suburbs.
I thought it was interesting the dynamic between Edsel and his father, that Edsel was very much interested in doing this, and Henry was very reticent in terms of building the whole facility.
Just for starters, Edsel Ford as a kid, I mean, you can imagine this as a young man. He's a kid, and his father is this poor, broke, you know, tinkerer and working in a shed in the backyard. And that's how he knows his father, is like this strange guy who doesn't have any money. And by the time Edsel's a young teenager, his father's probably the most famous man in the world. He's revolutionized human existence. And he idealized his father. And as a young man, Edsel had this idea he wanted to build airplanes because he comes of age as a kid and here's this airplane. The Wright brothers are building airplanes. And, you know, as a kid, this captured his imagination. And he looked at his father and what his father had done. And he thought that he would be an aviation pioneer and do for airplanes what his father had done for cars. And his life was very tragic and full of sad failures. And he was a man sort of way ahead of his time. And mm-hmm. I think that's why Willow Run when it came time to build these bombers, this aircraft for the war, Edsel was the man behind, you know, the force behind it. At the same time, he's dying of cancer, mm-hmm. and so he dies in 1943. Not sure whether this, you know, project is going to work. To me, it was a very moving father-son story.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Edsel involved in the whole Ford Trimotor thing, or?
He was. In fact, some will tell you that Edsel was the one that really pushed his father to invest in aviation in, mm-hmm. In the 1920s. And that becomes a big turning point in that industry as well, because Henry Ford brings not so much his mechanical know-how or his manufacturing prowess as he does just his reputation at that mm-hmm. point. People associate Ford Motor Company with quality and good things. So if Henry Ford's behind an airplane, that's got to be a good plane. And, mm-hmm. and it was. I mean, the Ford Mark Trimotor is one of the most important airplanes of the pre-World War II era. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as A.J. was saying, Edsel really is sort of a tragic story. There's no two ways about it. He's never able to fully emerge from his father's shadow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's made president of the company in the early 20s, but he's never given real control over the company. And it's sad how it ends, not only with Edsel's death from cancer, but he's just at sort of the edge at that point where Henry Ford now is starting to really physically slip. And, you know, if he'd lived a few more years, I think he might have been able to come into full flower and full control mm-hmm. of Ford Motor Company. And who knows what might have happened mm-hmm. then. But as it was, of course, he passes away and Henry Ford decides to come back as president of the company when he's clearly beyond his abilities at that point. And mm-hmm. The government gets concerned. President Roosevelt is concerned. You know, they think we're going to have to take over this company
really?
Because they're so important. Sure, because their war production is so essential. As it turns out, they don't have to. Henry Ford's wife, Clara, and Edsel's widow, Eleanor, are able to engineer almost a coup among mm-hmm. the family and get Henry Ford II, mm-hmm. Edsel's oldest son, appointed as president. But it was close, and you really do wonder what might have happened had Edsel Ford survived.
And then they named that unfortunate car after him. And
that's another part
of the
shame.
And that becomes his legacy. I think that's the sad part. I mean, I never realized that and his importance. Edsel's importance overall, and I think it's because, you know, maybe his father was just bigger than life, and that just overshadowed everything, or maybe it's because everybody said Edsel. Oh, that's that car.
I think it's both. I mean, the real sad thing about the Edsel car, it was such a failure. When the Edsel was launched, I think it was 1957. Massive amounts of money and marketing was put into that car. And it was really the creation of Edsel's son, Henry Ford II, who wanted to realize, you know, he wanted the world to realize that his dad was a great man, so he was going to create this car that would honor his father, and it was a disastrous failure. And I think Henry Ford II, I think that was a deeply troubling life experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Dan, before we let you go, any final observations, any final words that you want to share with the audience here?
Well, I would guess, you know, when you're in Detroit, you really need to come down and look around. There's still plenty of Detroit automotive history that survives. I mean, much of it has been demolished. But the Packard plant, for example, which for decades has been one of the biggest eyesores and one of Detroit's blackest eyes, a Peruvian developer is cleaning it up. We'll see whether, you know, it has new life or not. But that's certainly significant because it's really the last surviving plant other than the Model T plant in Highland Park, but even that, most of that's been demolished. Then, of course, the Highland Park plant itself and that administration building, I hear that there's some talk about trying to turn that into a tourist destination. The old American Motors building over on Plymouth Road, though abandoned and hit by some scrappers, that still stands. So, I mean, everywhere you look in Detroit, you know, there is a place for you to come check out, take photos. The Paquette plant, I almost forgot about the Paquette plant, still stands and is a museum that is definitely worth checking out for any auto buff. It's really fascinating to see how the auto industry started, how the assembly line started, and plus it's, you know, two floors basically of classic cars from turn of the century, American automakers, and really worth checking out. So come to Detroit and take in some of our past.
Okay. Well, want to thank you, Dan Austin. And by the way, his books are Forgotten Landmarks of Detroit and Lost Detroit. You can find these at bookstores, Amazon, I take it?
Yeah, pretty much anywhere, or through historicdetroit.org as well.
Okay. So Thank you, Dan. Okay, so we're going to be taking a quick break here. We'll come back with a number. John can't throw it to me since John's not here. I'll have to throw it to myself. So so we're going to have a shout-out to Bridgestone. Okay, and we're back. So as is typical at this point in the show, we're going to do the Dr. Data number, which seems very odd for me to say since John calls me Dr. Data, but as I say, he's not here. So this is a topic that is exceedingly topical for this time of year. We just had a big snowstorm in Detroit, and this is after it was 60 degrees here on Saturday. So very strange. So Carmen, could you bring up the first number, please? So we're number two. Now, obviously, we don't want to be number two in anything, but here we are. We're number two in what? Well, according to Gallup, 65% of Michigan residents are dissatisfied with the roads, which is trumped only by Rhode Island, which is number one, and 68% of its population is upset with the roads. Now, you and I live here. We deal with these roads all the time. AJ, you come here and drive around.
Can I weigh in on this one?
You can weigh in.
I have to say, I travel all over the country. I travel a lot. I live 17 years in New York City, 5 in Chicago. I don't find the roads around here any worse than Chicago's. Wow, Chicago roads are rough.
Really?
Boston's roads, terrible.
Huh.
I lost two tires to potholes last week.
There you go. Okay.
I will sympathize with this number, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, a couple, three weeks ago, we had a piece on about how Ford has developed this new suspension system that is being made available in the Fusion that will actually keep your car from bottoming out on potholes because the engineers live here and they said, you know, we really need something. So, anyway, Carmen, let's bring up the next slide, please. So, okay, so, you know, I can't leave Michigan as being number two in anything, okay? That just seems wrong. So we are number one in something, and as you can see, it's relative to that. So it turns out that Michigan's number one in not spending money on its roads, which explains why the roads are so bad. But I thought it was interesting to discover that actually Maine spends, you know, they're in number two position. But Rhode Island, the people who have the worst roads, are actually spending considerably more per capita than we are on roads. Go figure. So maybe they have fewer roads. I don't know.
Maine's roads are lovely, I have to say.
Yeah?
They are nice.
So you've driven around Maine?
Yeah, I used to live in the area.
Yeah?
Beautiful roads. Highway 95. I mean, it's Highway 95.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful straight pavement.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we're talking about very nice roads. So earlier this week, I was actually out in San Diego. You mentioned Coronado Hotel. I was not far from the Coronado Hotel. But so Kia has developed a new Sportage, and I had the opportunity to spend some time talking with Michael Sprague. Michael Sprague is the chief operating officer and executive vice president of Kia Motor America. And so talk to Michael about Kia's position in the market and some other things. So let's have Gary talk to Michael Sprague.
Hi, we're here in Borrego Springs where it's 91 degrees outside, and I know in many parts of the United States it's not 91 degrees outside. We're here with Michael Sprague, who is the Chief Operating Officer and Executive Vice President of Kia Motor America, launch of the all-new Sportage. But before we get to that car, you guys announced sales numbers for the month of February, and you guys are doing great. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we sold over 49,000 vehicles in February. And so we're up 13% year over year. So it was a very strong month. Sportage played a big part of it. Soul and Optima continue to play big parts of our sales success. So we were pretty pleased.
And it's been 10 months running that you guys have had month over month sales increases.
Yes, exactly.
Now you guys, last year you outperformed the auto industry in
yes.
terms of what Kia was doing. And what was the number and why did that happen?
That's a great question. I think the why is because we have a great portfolio of products that more and more people are discovering every day. The numbers were, we were up 7.9%. We sold 625,818 vehicles, so there's your number. The industry was up about 5.7%. Number one vehicle was the Optima, sold over 154,000 of them, followed by Soul and Sorento. and Optima and Sorento, as you know, are built in the United States at our plant down in West Point, Georgia. So back to the people discovering the brand, we've really been focusing on communications and telling people about this new Kia, because our entire portfolio of products has changed over the last couple of years.
You guys have been doing this transition now. I mean, it's been a cadence that you keep building on what you've done before.
Right.
You're becoming much more visible, I think, in terms of advertising the market. I mean, everybody knows that you guys did the hamsters, but
right.
You know, the Super Bowl ad that you guys did this year was rather interesting with Christopher Walken. Talk to us about that, and how did that work out for you?
Sure. So this was our seventh consecutive Super Bowl spot. The first one we did was back in 2010, where we introduced the Sorento that we were building down in Georgia. And every year, we go back and look at the return on our investment, and every year it's proven for us as a brand that's really trying to raise awareness here in the United States that this makes good business sense. And we see it both in the objective data, so visits to Kia.com, visits to third-party shopping sites, and then we also hear it subjectively from our dealers. They're saying, customers are coming in saying, I saw the spot, and now I want to see the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been tracking that for 7 years. So we've got a good foundation of data mm-hmm. to build off of. This year, we're introducing the new Optima. So we wanted to, you know, really kind of set ourselves apart within the category. You know, it's traditionally been known as kind of a boring segment, and the
right.
Optima really stands out. And we thought, what better way than to have Christopher Walken kind of communicate that message that you can live in this life of beige boringness, or you can live in a world of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, using the sock metaphor helped,
right.
and so effective.
And so you're wearing your colorful socks
I'm
down
not
here.
Any beige?
No
socks.
Beige.
No beige.
No beige
in my life.
Uh-huh. So Kia is not a beige brand.
We're not a beige
okay,
brand.
Okay. So I mean, so one of the things that you guys have done for in terms of transformation is that there's been this notion that, well, it's an inexpensive car you know, if I'm in the market and don't have much to spend. But you guys have changed that by, first of all, I would say, leading a design revolution.
Absolutely.
In terms of models from top to bottom. But you guys are also building quality vehicles. I mean, your numbers are much better in that category than they have in the past.
Absolutely. And you bring up a great point. The perception out there is just maybe we are the low-cost provider and probably don't have the best quality. But we're out there trying to communicate, no, we've got great quality. In fact, J.D. Power IQS, we were number two just after Porsche, beating the perennial favorites. Consumer Reports, we rank higher than, again, some of the brands that people consistently refer to mm-hmm. as having the best quality.
Right.
J.D. Power Reliability Study as well, we're number six. So the numbers are there. We have to communicate it to customers to mm-hmm. tell them that, to say, this is not the Kia that you remember from
right.
the old days. This is the new Kia. Mm-hmm. And to your point, the design, the product, it's all about product.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Schreier and his team have just delivered phenomenal product.
Mm-hmm. And so to wrap this thing up, I mean, I mentioned at the top that new Sportage. So tell us what the new Sportage means for you guys and what your anticipation is for that product.
Boy, I would say this is the right product at the right time. When you look at the growth in the CUV segments last year, if you look at all of the segments combined, the growth was 18%. Sportage was up 25% last year, so we kind of mm-hmm. you know, outpaced the industry.
Right.
Such demand in the small compact mm-hmm. CUV segment.
Right.
The Sportage is going to be perfectly placed. Well priced, a lot of value, great design, mm-hmm. and a really fun driving vehicle as
okay.
well. So we think it's going to be perfect.
All right. Michael Sprague, thank you very much for your time, and look forward to spending more time behind the wheel of the all new Sportage.
Great. Appreciate great. It. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And we're back to me. You know, I thought it was interesting if you know, you heard him mention in there that Kia has a plant that in West Point, Georgia, that they're building vehicles in. And, you know, I sort of get the sense that with companies like Kia and Hyundai, that we're having another development of the auto industry in the United States. Am I completely off base with this notion?
No, I think you've got a point there. And I think there's, you know, for several decades now, there's been this real blur. What is a domestic car versus what is a foreign car, an imported mm-hmm. car? I mean, is it a Kia that's built here in Georgia, or is it a Ford or something that's built in Mexico? And there really is no clear-cut lines anymore. So I think people aren't as bothered by that anymore. And I think, too, the idea that the imported cars, you know, are of higher quality, which was, you know, sort of accepted as standard in the 80s and even into the 90s, that's now begun to fade away a little bit now, too, as the, you know, the Detroit 3, as we call them now, have caught up in terms of quality. So there really is a more even competition field between the two, and I think we are seeing kind of a new age or a shifting in the automobile market and industry.
Right. And AJ, are you seeing companies like Kia getting more traction in terms of people saying, hey, I can consider them as viable?
Absolutely. I mean, without a doubt. Firstly, to the earlier point, we have Toyota winning NASCAR races. You know,
it's a new era. Won the championship last year.
Right? Yeah. It's a new era. We're in a different day and age. And people, because I drive a lot of cars, and people are always asking me, is this car good or is that car good? And Kia comes up and Hyundai comes up, and I say, oh, you can't. It's very hard to buy a bad car, no matter what kind of car it is these days. You know, when people go out and they're going to find, what is the right car for me? What feels the most comfortable? What is my price point? But the Kias I've driven, the Hyundai, these are wonderful cars. I certainly don't have anything bad to say about them.
And I wonder whether, you know, the fact that in the phone market, I mean, so it basically is Apple and Samsung, and Samsung being a Korean company, and Kia headquarters are in Korea, whether younger people might just say, well, why not? I mean, you know, what's the importance of Detroit or Dearborn or Auburn Hills?
I think a lot of people could just, at a very basic level, the visceral response is, this is a good product I can get for less. I think that's what people think.
And so the brand origin isn't all that important.
I think for millennials, it might not be. People like, I'm 44, I have very specific brand identities. But I'm not sure that the generations coming up have those same.
My impression would be the millennials, the price tag would appeal to them far more than the brand. You know,
really?
They're interested in lower-priced cars, so that whatever the brand, they'll go with them.
But it's interesting when I look at some of the Kias and the Hyundais now. I mean, their prices are comparable to, you know, what you can get from someone else. So while we're on the subject of vehicles and quality and so on and so forth, we also have a... an interview with Dan Sherman, who is the man in charge of product planning, who was behind the new Kia Sportage. So let's take a look at that.
We're here with Dan Sherman, who is the product planning manager for the 2017 Kia Sportage, fourth generation of the vehicle. So, Dan, I need to ask you, when we say something is all new, what do we mean? New.
When we say all new, what we're talking about is everything from the sheet metal all the way to the inside, all the way to the structure, to the bones of the car. So in that case, we're talking about our ISO structure. So we introduced ISO structure on the Sedona and the Sorento and the Optima, and now we've got it here on the Sportage.
ISO structure, what does that mean?
ISO structure is our general terminology for a really, really stiff structure. And what that means is that we've upped our game in terms of our advanced high-strength steel usage, in terms of our usage of industrial adhesive as well. So we're actually 51% advanced high-strength steel now on this car in the body in white.
And so what does that mean for someone who's going to get this car? For someone who's like, woo, we got steel, great.
So it means a whole bunch of things. I mean, the bones of the car really make a difference in terms of the way that it drives, the way that it crashes, and the way that it sounds or really doesn't sound. So NVH is very key as well.
So the development of this vehicle had to be important for a couple of reasons. One is that ever since Kia has been in the U.S., there has been a Sportage. That's number
correct.
One. Number two, compact crossover vehicle, hot segment. So what did you guys do from an engineering point of view that you think will make this even more competitive than the product it replaces?
I think that the three big areas that we spent a lot of time on were the ride quality, which is helped by that ISO structure, and also a totally retuned suspension with fully isolated front and rear subframes. The NVH, which, as we talked about, the noises really come down a lot. It's a very isolated ride. And a lot of the competitors in this class are using variants of the C-segment platforms, which, you know, this has a lot of Optima in it, and therefore it's a lot more refined. And then the third point
Optima
is the interior.
Optima being your larger sedan.
Optima being our mid-size sedan.
Right.
You got it. As opposed to their Forte-size sedans. And then lastly, we've got the interior, where we went with a lot of soft-touch plastics. It's a beautiful, simple, clean design with great ergonomics.
Right. So this car was styled in Europe primarily?
Primarily, although all three design houses did have a hand in it.
So that would be?
That would be in the U.S., in Europe, and in Korea.
So is there something about the European styling that you guys wanted to capture with this vehicle to separate it from the other competitors?
Of course we did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, so many of our competitors are really styled all in the same direction. And we wanted to go a totally different direction because we're Kia. We have to be a little different. We have to take some risks. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to take some of that European flavor and impart it here.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about the interior. I mean, have you upped your game there in terms of the fit and finish of the materials, the soft materials versus the harder materials?
Absolutely. The whole dashboard is now soft touch on the top. The tops of the door panels in the front are soft touch, as well as the side cards, as well as the armrests. Mm-hmm. They're soft touch materials pretty much everywhere.
Right.
Even if you just feel when you initially get in the leather that's on the steering wheel, it's grades better than the previous vehicle.
Okay. So let's talk about what's under the hood.
Sure. So the 2-liter turbo in this particular car, in the SX Turbo, very strong, 240 horsepower. And very few of our competitors actually offer something with that amount of horsepower in this class.
And the standard offering is?
Standard offering is a 2.4-liter, 181 horsepower engine, also stronger than most of our competitors' base engines.
Mm-hmm. And these engines have been retuned, recalibrated?
Yeah, think of it as a facelift. They've been recalibrated for this. There's better fuel economy. We added technologies like electronic CVVT, and we went to a dual belt setup, and what we've essentially been chasing is better fuel economy and better drivability on a day-to-day basis.
So drivability, explain what you mean by that.
Drivability is your ability to just get into the car and go, and intuitively, everything about the throttle, everything about the way that the car drives makes sense, that it's easy to drive.
Okay.
But that means a lot of smoothness is very important.
All right, so we can't end this without talking a little bit about the technology that you guys bring. You guys are going to offer Apple CarPlay, Android Auto. But you also have other safety technologies in this car. Tell us some of the...
That's true. We went big with the adaptive driving systems, the driver assist systems. So we've introduced blind spot detection. And unlike most of our competitors, we've got lane change assist, which actually can see up to 230 feet behind the vehicle to see oncoming, approaching traffic that's driving too fast into the lane next to you. Mm-hmm. We've got rear cross traffic alert. We've got forward collision warning along with automated emergency braking, which can bring the vehicle to a full stop. We've got front and rear park assist as well. Just a litany of technology.
Mm-hmm. And so, and you can also open the hatch without using your hands.
That's one of the coolest parts. Uh-huh. And that's something that's very unique to Kia.
Yeah.
Is that there's no waving of the foot. Uh-huh. There is no hand, necessary. You can be holding something. All you have to do is stand behind the hatch for 3 seconds and poof, magic sesame.
And then you get in and drive it.
You got it.
Dan, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Gary.
So appreciate it very much.
Appreciate it.
So.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, we're back from Borrego Springs, and it's going to snow here in Detroit today. Two things that I want to talk about. I mentioned Apple CarPlay, but speaking of Apple, Sergio Marchionne, the head of FCA, said this week in Geneva that Apple should hesitate before it considers becoming a vehicle manufacturer. Now, we've talked, this whole show has been about mavericks who have been getting into the auto industry. What do you guys think about the possibility of Apple becoming an auto manufacturer, or should they, as Sergio also goes on to say, have a company like FCA build Apple cars?
I think this is fascinating. The whole revolution of autonomous driving has placed a spotlight on an unforeseen battle, a business battle, a battle of the minds technology between technology companies like Google and Apple, specifically Google, and car manufacturers. It's fascinating. I think the year 2015 will go down, and people write this history 20 years from now, is the year when the car manufacturers caught up to what was going on in Silicon Valley and surpassed them. I myself set lap times in an Audi. I was not the only journalist who did this. An Audi at Sonoma, driving itself, set a lap time on a racetrack that beat my own. I mean, that's incredible. What I predict will happen in the future is that these companies are all going to be working together to create products by car manufacturers with Apple software and components inside them.
What's your sense, Matt?
Well, I would say if Apple wants to get into the car business, good luck to them. It's a good way to lose a lot of money, that's for sure. But they are in a position to do that. They certainly have the war chest to finance it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But we're absolutely looking at some big future.
See, my sense of it is that it seems to me that if I were Apple and I wanted to get into the car business, what I would do is actually work with a supplier rather than work with an OEM. Because the supplier basically is going to bring most of the technology anyway, right? I mean, OEMs don't develop all that much technology themselves. So I would work with them in terms of building one, but that's just me.
You're discussing like the strategy that Haas has used to create the first American Formula One car in 30 years. You know, they're creating this, they're creating this American race car, but it's really sourced from all of these different, you know, those Ferrari engine and components that they're buying from everywhere.
Right. And machined on Haas machines. And okay, so you mentioned autonomous cars. So the news came out this week that the Google car was involved in an accident. It isn't the first time a Google car has been involved in an accident. They've been in accidents before, but this was the first time that the Lexus RX that they're using in Mountain View, one of the Lexi that they're using in Mountain View, they're running 23 of the vehicles, got into an accident with a bus. Now, my understanding is that there was a series of sandbags in front of the Google car. It needed to get around it, and it merged over, and it sideswiped a bus, the Google car going 2 miles an hour and the bus going 15 miles an hour. There was a driver who could have taken over, but the driver thought the bus was going to slow down for us because that's what they should be doing. So this raises a whole situation in terms of is this going to put a damper on the development of autonomous vehicles, or is this going to be just part and parcel with what should be happening?
It's interesting. Coincidentally, there's a big cover story in Time magazine this week about driverless cars. And the crux of the story is that, you know, this isn't academic anymore. They're here. This thing is happening. So I don't think this incident's really going to throw them off. But that said, you know, I don't envy the driverless car. We human drivers can make mistakes, get in accidents all the time. That happens. We're only human. But the self-driving car has to be perfect all of the time before people start to doubt. I don't think this is going to be a big problem.
And AJ, you've been in the Google car.
I drove around Mountain View in a car driving itself, built by Google. Well, it was a Lexus,
right?
With Google software. And I have to say, the whole idea is simple here. These cars are built because computer technology is going to fail less than humans will. Percentage-wise, the computer systems and the radar are much less likely to make mistakes. So I think there's no question that in the future these vehicles will be safer. But while driving around Mountain View in this Google car, my sense of it was I felt more comfortable and safer in that car than than I would with many of the drivers I'm with frequently.
So, I mean, did you feel comfortable because there was presumably a steering wheel and a brake pedal and an accelerator that you could have taken control, or maybe you were with an engineer and he could have taken control? Or
I was with an engineer, but my sense was, I'm of a generation where I've been surrounded by computer technology for all of my adult life, and I've seen it fail. But most of the time, I put my trust in these machines, you know, when I'm writing. And I just trusted that the machine was going to do the right thing. And I knew, you know, it had radar, and it was explained to me how it was going to work. And I trusted the machine, and it didn't fail me.
You know, I've seen one argument that was basically saying, once upon a time, there used to be elevator operators, maybe in the Pontchartrain. And how at some point we all became very comfortable in getting into these boxes and pushing the buttons ourselves and not having someone take us to a floor analogously to the autonomous car.
That's an excellent point. It's funny, just as an aside, did you know that Enzo Ferrari, the great Ferrari manufacturer, was afraid of elevators? Strange man. But yes, I think that's a great point.
So what's your prediction? Okay, so you study the history of the transportation. What do you think we'll be seeing in terms of autonomous vehicles? I mean, are we going to, 5 years from now, are you going to leave the studio and go out there and climb into a car that's going to take you back to Dearborn?
5 years might be a little optimistic, but I wouldn't be surprised if within the next 10 we have some fully automated cars that are available at the higher end of the market. I think it's a natural evolution. I mean, the car's been getting easier to drive since the very beginning. I mean, everything from the automatic transmission to lane assist or lane keeping that we have now. So it'll happen.
AJ?
I think a lot of this technology is already in our cars. You buy a new car today, and again, an upper-level car, something you're going to spend more money. It's full of this technology. These cars, within the next couple of years, they'll be lane changing. The cars in traffic up to 37 miles an hour, something like that. They're going to change lanes by themselves. They're going to be driving themselves. This is all coming, and I think it's going to be a good thing. Infrastructure-wise, it's going to be radical because we're going to have to rethink the insurance industry. All sorts of other industries are going to have to get on board. Public policy.
Mm-hmm. So I got to ask, you're in Northern California. Is there a place in Northern California where technology car guys get together the same way the early technology car guys got together in that bar in downtown Detroit?
Absolutely. There's a lot of very wealthy people in Silicon Valley who are very interested in cars. So I don't run in that clique, really. I drive an old Subaru, and sometimes I get invited to these parties, but it's quite a scene.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we should wrap it up there. And so A.J. Baim, the author of many things, including The Arsenal of Democracy, which...
Thank you very much.
I highly recommend people read that. Matt Anderson of the Henry Ford, curator of the transportation department there.
Thank you. Great to be
here. Thank you. And it's just fascinating stuff. And Dan Austin, who's no longer with us. So next week, we're putting something together special. We'll see if it all works out. So please stay tuned for that to get more information about that. 2 weeks from now, we're going to be having the head of Domino's USA. Domino's, yes, the pizza company. Why are we going to have a pizza company in here? Well, Domino's has decided that it could have a competitive advantage in terms of transportation. So we will reveal all of that 2 weeks from now. So thanks for joining us. And I think my work here may be done. Yes, it is. So thanks for everybody for watching.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion.